Earth and Sky.
Welcome to Clear Voices. I'm Lindsay Patterson. You may not have heard of Ecological Debt Day before, but it happens every year. It's the one day that divides the part of the year where we have enough natural resources to meet people's demands on the Earth and the part of the year that we don't. That is, we're in ecological debt. I spoke to Matthijs Vakernagel, Executive Director of the Global Footprint Network, about the idea of Ecological Debt Day and what we can do to slow down our appetite for resources and better manage our natural assets. How do you celebrate Ecological Debt Day, or how did you celebrate?
We mark it.
You mark it. So you don't celebrate at all.
No, we slaughtered a big lamb and roasted it and had a lot of beer.
Really, that would be more interesting.
Wouldn't it be? Yeah.
So what did you actually do? Did you have any particular way that you personally observed the day, though it's marked?
It's a reminder, and that's why we chose a day that it becomes much more experiential, because we feel the year. How long is a year? How much do we use? And then to get a sense, what does it actually mean to use 30% more than Earth regenerates? Oh, wow, by today, actually, what we've used collectively is already as much as Earth can regenerate over the whole year. And then what about the next remaining months, you know, and our Thanksgiving dinner? Where does it come from? So it's a time of reflection.
So I've seen that there has been an Ecological Debt Day since 1987.
Yeah.
And so it's been moving steadily earlier in the year?
It's moving earlier every year. As long as resource demand is increasing, and it has been increasing pretty steadily. Yeah, first approximation on average, about 3 days, it gets earlier every year.
And what's the main driver of that?
I mean, there are many drivers overall. There are about five drivers that determine the difference between how much we have and how much we use. So two drivers are how much biocapacity, this is the biocapacity, how much biocapacity we have, and it's how much area is productive and how productive is it per acre. And then the other three factors are on the demand side. So how big is the population times how much is being consumed, and then how efficiently is this consumption being provided. So that then generates the overall demand.
So what is actually happening to our planet as we're going farther and earlier into ecological debt?
Like in our private finances, we can spend money more rapidly than we earn it for some time. Then we go into debt or we liquidate our assets and eventually go bankrupt. The same thing happens with ecological assets. We can use them faster than they regrow. We can cut timber more rapidly than it regrows, and we have deforestation in the long run. We can overfish and the fishery collapses. And we can overuse, or we can put more CO2 in the atmosphere, and then we have CO2 buildup in the atmosphere. So there's some buffer for overusing natural capital, but only so much. So eventually it leads to the social outcome is misery. We see that already in some places of the world, particularly in more rural areas, poorer rural areas, or if we look at Haiti or Darfur, where resource constraints have become very severe, and they translate into social conflicts. And particularly there, because in poor areas, people are not able to, they don't have enough financial assets to buy resources from elsewhere. So once they are living in an area of ecological scarcity, that's what they're stuck with, and it makes life very difficult.
So how do we go about slowing ecological debt, and does it have anything to do with slowing down climate change?
Climate change is a big part, probably one of the most prominent symptoms of this overarching problem of us using more and more of the biosphere's capacity, or the overarching problem that the biosphere has become too small compared to our resource demand overall. It is all about how can we manage better our overall metabolism. Now, how can we do that? We would think there are like three key areas that we would focus on. One is just very simply, we need, like any banker that wants to exactly know what are the expenditures and what are the revenues in order to understand is the capital going up or down, you know? So in the same way, we need to have a reliable, robust accounting of our ecological assets to understand to what extent we are losing or gaining in our ecological assets, and we believe we are losing very rapidly, and in the end, ecological assets are the most significant asset base we depend on, because that's what all the wealth, where all the wealth emerges from. Now, the next thing to do is to look at what we call slow things first. You need to look at the slow changing stocks. What are they? Infrastructure like buildings, roads, power plants, or people being born today. All of these stocks, they have long lives, and they will determine for decades to come to what extent we consume resources or not. So to what extent we are building ourselves traps or opportunities or not. And then the third part, I'd say, is what the third area of focus. We need to put our innovative capacity, and we have a lot of innovation potential here, not just in the United States, in many places, to drive solutions forward that can help us live well within the means of one planet. But, of course, this innovation needs to be driven. It doesn't happen on its own. We need to give support to these kind of technological innovations.
So how can you, as an individual, if you're already kind of trapped into the infrastructure, say you were just brought up in Houston and your family's there and you kind of have to stay, what can a person there do to kind of ease their personal debt?
Yeah, I mean, there are many things we can do just looking at the big ticket items that have long-term implications. Like, what are the stocks that we put in place ourselves? And then the answers become pretty obvious. For example, what kind of a house are you buying? Are you buying one that is close to public transportation and in a more compact neighborhood where you can walk around and you don't need your car so much? These would be houses that would be gaining in value overall, I think, as well. So it may be economically wise, too, to buy an energy-efficient house in a compact neighborhood. And also, it will allow you to live in a more vibrant neighborhood where you can access coffee shops. And the second one would be transportation, obviously. And what kind of a car, if you need a car, do you buy? Are you buying an energy-intensive one or not? That will make much more of a difference over its lifetime than trying to drive carefully in your car. I mean, that makes a big difference as well, but what kind of a car you have will largely determine your overall energy expenditures over its lifetime. Another obviously big stock that we are associated with as humans is how large is our family? So do we have a lot of children or a few children? So because every child then again will have will become an adult and then have these kind of resource consumption. So that's another area where we make long-term decisions about the future, about humanity's future resource consumption. So it's not just about everyday behavior, but it's the big decisions that we take in our lives that have the largest ramification for our future.
That was Matthijs Bakkernagel, Executive Director of the Global Footprint Network. And I'm Lindsay Patterson for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.